Hello, and happy almost end of January. I cannot believe that we are basically in February. Like, it makes no sense to me. And I've completely lost track of time. I've lost track of my calendar. I don't know what's going on. I've missed a few meetings in my head, and it is just a bit of a mess. So I feel like I'm still adjusting maybe after the holidays, but I don't know what's going on. Maybe it's just lockdown 3.0 and this idea that we don't actually know when we're getting out of lockdown. Perhaps that's it. I don't know. Don't know if you're feeling the same way. But other than that, the only other update I really have is that Clubhouse has just taken over my life. I'm literally on it almost like 8 hours a day. I don't know. That might be an exaggeration, but I'm on it a lot. There was one night where I was in a Clubhouse room and I literally fell asleep while I was in the room. And I woke up 2 hours later. It was like 2:30 a.m. And the room was still going and nobody had noticed that I had fallen asleep. It was very confusing. But yeah, that is now the world we live in. Hyper-connected even when we're sleeping. So today's episode, for the first time ever, I'm going to say this. I am so proud of this episode. And I'm not proud of myself for it. I'm proud of knowing women like Dr. Tina Mistry because she's a powerhouse. The way that she talks about the different topics that we cover, ranging from mental health to conscious parenting, to what it is to discipline your child, to intergenerational trauma, which is a term that's been floating around the internet for a few months now. This idea that we carry trauma from our grandparents in our DNA. And as South Asians, of course, many of us have been impacted by the partition. And so we're all carrying that trauma inside us. We also cover topics such as toxic masculinity and how that sort of stems from when you're a child, on racism, what it was like for Dr. Tina growing up in the 80s and not speaking to her parents about racism, unless it was those really extreme cases that were almost told as like gimmicky stories. And a life of intention, I think, which is so nuanced and subtle as a topic, but living consciously and creatively, and also this idea that it is not sufficient to just be a consumer, but to also be a creator, because that's where you unlock fulfillment, that's where you unlock purpose, and I guess ultimate contentment. So there's a wide range of stuff, but I am so, so proud to have had this conversation. And it's almost like a little guidebook for anyone who is an expecting parent, a new parent, a parent of young kids or young teenagers, or even a parent of an adult. I feel like you need to listen to this if you are a parent, especially if you're a South Asian parent, just because there's so many things in there that I personally have not really uncovered. Maybe it's because I'm not a parent myself. And so this was an extremely important learning experience for me. So yeah, if you are a parent or if you know a parent, honestly, if you feel like it's useful, share it with them, because I think more people need to listen to this and more people need to start following the teachings of Dr. Tina Mistry, because she is fantastic. I want to talk a little bit about her brand, Brown Psychologist, and what it stands for before we dive into the episode. And then I'll shut up, I promise. So Brown Psychologist is a platform to discuss mental health, specifically within the South Asian community, to discuss whatever it is we go through as South Asians and tie that back into mental health. And also to just help guide the entire community to get more psychologically in tune with themselves and with their families. And I think this episode is such a great starting point. If you are interested in these topics, then you should definitely, definitely check her out. But honestly, I'm just so, so proud. So yeah, that said, I will pass you on to the incredible Dr. Tina Mistry, also known as Brown Psychologist.
Just trying to put the little ones to sleep, which isn't always the easiest of feats, sadly. Yesterday they went to bed quite early, which was good. Today they just want to sing, so you might be able to pick up their singing in the background, which is quite hilarious. Actually, they're singing all Disney lullaby songs. So,
oh, I love that. Well, I guess there's never a dull moment at home.
No, No, there isn't. There's always something happening in the mystery household, believe me.
I'm sure there are moments where you're just like, I just want to breathe and be on my own.
Yes, there are plenty of them. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the joys of parenting, isn't it? I think it's, you know, that is why you do what you do, you know, that it is a kind of constant giving. And that's why it's so important to try and make sure that you do get time for yourself as well. So, yeah. Lockdown has definitely tested. Yeah, it's definitely tested us 100%. But we're just grateful that we have each other. Mm. That's all you can do, really.
And how have you been coping in the last few months?
So as a family, we initially, I think with the whole lockdown thing, everybody just did what they could to manage and cope. And we literally, it felt like we were just scraping, you know, doing the bare minimum. Like homeschooling, for example, is like, gosh, how do we do this? I'm not a trained teacher. How do I keep them involved? How do I get them to do all the things that, you know, will be helpful for them? So it felt like it was just like, just survive, you know, and with trying to work at the same time, I had to scale back everything that I was doing, so that I could almost meet the needs of the kids, meet the needs of the clients. And yeah, it was tricky. And then you start to eat your stress, drink away your stress. So that is what happened as well, you know. And then you get to a point where you think, oh my gosh, what am I doing to myself? And yeah, you start to almost come out of it. And I was going through a phase of transition anyway with my business and what I was doing. And I think that lockdown had forced our hand in a way to reevaluate what was working and what was not working, as a business. And what wasn't working was the whole kind of trying to offer something face to face, and with the business that I wanted to grow, it had to shift and change. So that's kind of what I decided to do, and just go 100% digital, so online offerings. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was testing. And I think as a family, what was great was that we just slowed right down, and we had quite a few weddings planned, like, you know, family weddings and days out, this and that, and that all stopped. Which was weird, because we normally see like both sides of the family at least, you know, once or twice a month. That was the plan. So we didn't really get to see them. That was quite difficult. And then we just kind of found that we spent our time just doing bits in the house, and we found that we could be quite adventurous with our time, you know. Small things. I think small things really made a difference. So little things like planting seeds, little things like playing board games, little things like getting the paddling pool up, things that we probably wouldn't have done because we as a family are quite busy. We're very, you know, always got things going on, like going here, going there. So we rarely really spent that much time at home. And we also got more time to do bits around the house, like painted the girls' rooms and finished my husband's kind of garden project that he had. So it was just things like that. And then we kind of spent more time with the girls riding bikes, things like that. And it kind of pushed my husband to get a bike. And then now I've got a bike. So we're kind of doing these family cycling things, which is so cool now. And yeah, I think that the lockdown has taught us we don't have to be going here, there and everywhere all the time. And I think that this is the problem with modern day life, especially being Asian, I think, is that we have so many family events and things to do. We feel obliged to see this person, see that person, that we actually don't take stock of what we have and prioritize the little family moments that, say, back in the day was quite the norm, you know. I remember growing up and, you know, my parents just suddenly packing a picnic and before you know it, you're in Skegness. And do you know what I mean? That's kind of how the life was back in those days. Even if it was, you know, potato curry and paratha or whatever, it was still, we were going somewhere by the beach or something like that. So, yeah, I feel like that we'd somehow managed to get ourselves in this really fast paced life. And now we don't need to be there anymore, and that's quite nice in a way.
Have you sent your kids to school?
I have. I've made the decision to send them to school simply because I feel like that they should be there. If I'm able to work and I can work around them, and you know, kind of they need to be there, and I can see already within the space of they've been back, this is their third week, the positive impact it's had on their kind of well-being. They're with their peers, they're with children their own age, they are learning at the right pace and the right way. You know, they're not just stuck to screens all day. You know, they're playing outside, they're having conversations about kids stuff, you know, which is so great, because in one way we're quite blessed in that I've got two girls and they're quite similar in age, so they've got each other. As much as they bicker, as sisters do, as siblings would do, they've got each other. So that was one thing that was a bit of a saving grace, but I think it's quite important for them to have their own friends, you know, their own space, their own kind of ways of interacting with other children, really. So, yeah.
Children's mental health is something that, you know, is really not spoken about. And it's only now in lockdown that I've seen firsthand, I guess, at work with some of my managers, some of my senior managers who've got kids now. And they tell me stories about what it's been like all these months with their kids at home, just kind of losing their minds and missing their friends and feeling sad. Do you work with children's mental health? And kind of what are your thoughts around the whole topic, and why do you think it's not spoken about enough?
I think that there's this assumption that children don't have mental health, that children are these little mini beings that just have behavioural outbursts and are, you know, difficult to manage at times. And yeah, I totally can get why people think like that, but actually it's the total opposite. To answer your question, I don't work directly with children. In private practice, I did used to when I was working for the NHS and private services, but in my practice now I don't. I feel like that when you're working with children, you need a family approach. It's not just treating the child independently. You have to work with the child's issues and also bring in the parents along with you. And I feel that one person often can't accommodate that in private practice. I think that actually the best approach for that is when you've got like a few members of other therapists or a team around you to do that work. So you're holding, let's say one therapist is holding the parents in mind and one's holding the child in mind, and you come together and you work as a team. I feel that that often is the best approach when working with more than one person. But there are family therapists who are trained in that particular field that can work with families individually as well. Like, so they are the individual therapist working with that family. Why is it so important? Because we all have mental health as much as we have physical health, and that a child's brain and a child's mind is so spongy and so kind of prime to being impacted that it can have long-term effects. So many of the issues that I tend to see when I'm working with the adults that I'm working with is that we would often reflect back to the traumas that they may have experienced during childhood. So these could be small things. We call them small T's, but they're quite big. They're enough to wound us, as the kind of language goes. So, for example, one of the areas that I'm really interested in is how, especially within the South Asian community, of how mothers often are absent from the nurturing roles, the emotional nurturing roles for their children, because they have so many other demands placed on them that often that part, sadly, is taken away from them. So they can't emotionally mother their children. And this is often the case when you've lived in multi-generational families, and you'll often see, or kind of, I speak to adults, you know, and I ask about what's their relationship like with their mother, and how did you find it growing up, and what was mum like when she was, you know, what do you remember about mum? And often some children would say, I barely remember mum, you know, I barely remember kind of the interactions we had. I just remember her being there, you know, this sort of presenteeism, as we call it. And one of the biggest problems that comes out of those kind of relationships is that the children who grow up in those kind of environments grow up feeling like they haven't had somebody tune into their emotional needs. Mm. So this results in the child growing up not really knowing how to self-soothe, or not really knowing how to manage their own emotions. Mm. And on the other end of the spectrum, you also hear how the kind of typical parenting would be authoritative parenting, where the parent will be kind of like demanding the child to stop crying, you know, shouting at them if they're misbehaving, expecting them to adhere to rules set out by what the parent wants. And, you know, back in the day, how children were parented was that way, was that actually it's the adult's world and the child should conform to the adult. Well, actually, what we know is that the child does not know, hasn't got the rules, hasn't even got the brain functioning to be able to function in an adult's world. That's why they are children. Mm. And that is why, as adults, we need to change the way that we mold our environments for children. And it's hard, because when you have been an adult for so long, you just want everything to run smoothly. Like, for example, bedtime, you know, you know you've got things to do as a parent, and all you want them to do is just get into bed. And I've had, you know, I haven't had tantrums, thank God, but I have had, mommy, I'm not tired. Mommy, I'm still hungry. Mommy, can you read to me? So it's really about just being with them along that journey. But also reminding them of that there are boundaries, you know, children need boundaries as well. They need that kind of like line to say, okay, right, it is bedtime now. It's dark outside. You need to go to sleep because you're going to wake up in the morning. And it's really about empowering them as well. So one of the things I left my daughter to do is to listen to music to help her fall asleep. Why don't she go and choose the music? What is it that you want to listen to? And don't forget to set your alarm. So she's 5 years old. And for her, that's like, oh yeah, big girls do that. So for her, that's mm-hmm. quite encouraging for her, because we're trying to get her to fall asleep by herself. So, yeah, it's tricky parenting. There's no sort of hard and fast rules around what you should and shouldn't do. But what I would remind people who are parents to do is to almost try and tune into how your child is feeling right now. What's underneath their behavior? And with lockdown, it's exactly the same thing, is that if as adults we struggled with the lack of social communication, or social, being able to socialize with other human beings, how difficult must it be for children, you know, to be without children of their own age, you know, to be cooped up inside the house. Maybe some children don't even have gardens. We are lucky enough that we do have some outdoor space. So it's all of these things that actually are so important for children's well-being. And conversations are hugely important, because, again, often adults feel like that you can't have these conversations with children when in fact you can. It's just about tailoring to their developmental age. So, you know, just asking about if they can draw us a face that kind of shows how they're feeling right now. So we use inside out often as a descriptor of, oh, are you feeling, you know, ew, ew, you know, that one, disgust. No, mommy, it's anger, you know. So it's about making it playful, and you just get an insight. You don't need to know everything. They can just give you a little bit of an insight into what it feels like. And they don't often stay there for too long. But ultimately what I say to people is read your children. You know how to read people, read children. It's not difficult. But what we have to do is get out of our own heads first and our own bodies and our own emotions before we can do that. And that often is one of the biggest blockers for many adults, is that we're so stuck in our own minds and own feelings and own troubles that we can't see past that. And this is the bit that I was talking about before, is that many of us were parented by parents that already had so many other issues going on in their lives. They couldn't see us and our struggles.
Absolutely. That's so, so true. And I was going to say, I love Inside Out because I think it's such a cleverly done film.
Yeah.
And the point that you made about the way that parents often almost project what's going on in their lives onto their children, I think is such a strong point. And I personally have not really interacted with that many kids recently, but from my experiences growing up and just seeing parents around me as well and the way that they were treating their children, often I saw that, especially as a South Asian, I'd say, or just as, you know, someone with an ethnic background, I often noticed that a lot of the things that people remember about their mums growing up is that their mums would nag them a lot, you know, go to sleep at this time, you have to eat everything on your plate, you know. There was a lot of like, you can't do this and you have to do that. And I think the vocabulary around it was so almost like controlling and restrictive in the way that it was portrayed, almost that there was some sort of resentment there. I mean, you learn to let go of it as you become older and you appreciate them for everything they've gone through and done for you. But definitely, I think it's so interesting that you're talking about parenting from such a different perspective and such a conscious perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. It has to be done, because I think that generation after generation, what I hear is that each generation wants to do something different for their children. So it's really important to remember that. What is it that you as a parent, if there are parents listening, what is it you want differently for your children? Is it that you want to be more in tune with them? Is it that you want to offer them the emotional kind of attunement that maybe you didn't have as a child? You may have had all the wonderful things in the world, all the great experiences and, you know, privileges, but often what people talk about is that lack of, you know, space for them fully. And even as adults, I think that, you know, adult children, people still struggle with this whole acceptance by their parents, because parents have such a fixed and rigid way of expecting their children to turn out. So that's really, really difficult one. And I think that a lot of the, generation, you know, the next generation of parents, that they are more likely to have these open conversations with their children and give them much more freedom and less binary restrictions, and be more nuanced in their parenting approaches. And like you said, you used the word conscious, you know, it's about really being conscious of the way that you parent. So because, you know, our culture is getting so much more fluid in its thinking, it's so much more open. You know, I remember growing up not ever having a conversation about racism, never with my parents. Wasn't a thing. All I remember once was when my mum told me about the racism that one of my uncles had faced when they migrated from East Africa. But that was about it. Never kind of asked about how I was feeling or anything like that. Never. It was the, you know, extreme, direct, violent racism that they had experienced in the 70s. So my experiences would seem minute or kind of, you know, not even relevant. Whereas now we are being so conscious and mindful. We're talking about colorism and shadism, and, you know, we're talking about gender stereotypes and actually how we shouldn't hold them and how boys can do this and girls can do this. And actually, you know, there's this in between as well. And there's no such thing as, you know, it's only just men and women that get married. You know, I remember the kind of when the whole kind of homosexuality thing came out and, you know, gosh, my parents couldn't even cope with that, you know, back in the 80s. It was like, what is this, you know? But now we hold it so differently. We accept it so differently. And I think that what we're doing as parents is we are thinking more about not only how do we hold on to the good bits about our culture and celebrate them, because yes, I think that we were parented in a way that our parents were frightened of the very thing that, you know, is happening to a degree, is that we are losing some of our heritage and our culture. But I think that we're not just blindly consuming our cultural kind of, you know, expectations like they did. We're questioning it and we're challenging it, and then we're holding on to the bits that we really like and maybe binning the bits that we don't like. So, yeah, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see how the next generation continue to parent with respect to our heritage and how it's held. Because for me, what would be wonderful is to see this hybridity, like, you know, the New York Italians. They've got their own way of kind of celebrating themselves, like the, you know, Latinos in America, you know. So I think that British Asians are clearly doing that to a degree, but we own our bits of our heritage, but also mix and blend it with the bits of being British, you know. So I think that's quite cool. So yeah, who knows what's gonna happen.
Yeah, the lines for us are so much more blurred. You're completely right. I think that does come with a lot of confusion. I know I've definitely experienced a lot of that myself, of not knowing where, you know, if I'm British or if I'm Spanish or if I'm Indian. Ooh. And not feeling like I fit in anywhere, really. And I want to talk to you about intergenerational trauma, because I think you have touched on this fact that our parents and their parents, they were going through a very different time. And, you know, those more nuanced conversations, there was no space for them because they were going through something completely different at the time. So could you explain to me what you define intergenerational trauma to be and how that has impacted you and your children?
So when I first kind of learned about this concept of intergenerational trauma, it was like penny dropping moment. Of course, trauma is inherited. And then I started to look up at the research that was demonstrating that, and it literally just blew my mind. So I've been working with clients for a long time, and what I couldn't quite understand often was, why did they present the way they did, and why do they react and respond the way they did? And I would go back, say, to how they were parented, and sometimes a trauma would be present or there would be small red flags, but we wouldn't go beyond that. And then I looked at this word, generational trauma, intergenerational trauma, inherited trauma. There's lots of different words for it. And what that terminology describes is actually the trauma that somebody experiences. I should really switch that off. The trauma that somebody experiences is not only psychological, it actually impacts the biological. So what I mean by that is that, for example, what we understand trauma does is it impacts our cortisol levels, so that we are excreting cortisol at a higher level than, say, somebody who hasn't had a trauma. And cortisol is the hormone that actually helps us to get back to kind of like a more chilled level. So when it's high, you know that there's been trauma in the body. So it's about trying to create this kind of homeostasis, or this kind of like level planing. That's the job of cortisol. So we know that biologically and psychologically, trauma can affect us. And what the research was finding was that grandchildren from the Holocaust, so the Holocaust survivors, were exhibiting similar cortisol levels as their grandparents. And that, as a kind of finding, was just like, what? How is that even possible? And they look, all the research, similarly with Holocaust survivors, they did research in Aboriginal Native Americans as well. So there's lots of research done in Australia and North America of this same vein, that actually what happens is that the adult who experiences said trauma, be it a collective trauma, be it an individual trauma, can be so damaged or can be so affected that it then shapes and affects the DNA of their offspring, which then affects the DNA of their offspring. So it goes down two generations. And there's this really wonderful illustration that shows how this actually works. So there's a woman who is pregnant. You'll see an illustration of this woman who is pregnant. And inside her is her daughter. And inside that daughter is the egg of her granddaughter. So what we don't realize is that babies in utero, in the womb, already have the eggs for their offspring. So when I was carrying my eldest daughter, whilst I was carrying my daughter, I was also carrying my potential granddaughter, which is it's kind of like, when you think of that, that's just like, wow, it's amazing that actually the this is how advanced the body is. But also at the same time, it just goes to show how fragile our body is, in a way that actually a trauma can impact generations and generations. So what we know is that this, the more recent literature talks about how women who were pregnant at the time of the 9/11 bombings actually went on to produce children that were easily stressed. So their threshold for stress was much lower than, say, somebody who was not pregnant at the time of 9/11 or wasn't in that vicinity. So this is what we're seeing. We're seeing how trauma is inherited, trauma is passed down. And it can present in many different ways. So, for example, we know within our histories that many South Asians, in particular in the northern states of India and Pakistan, were part of, and Bangladesh, were part of partition, right? They all had some history around that. And I didn't know this until I think it was last year or the year before, where we were just talking about my great-granddad. So this is my maternal great-granddad. So my mum's dad. And she said, oh, yeah, he was born in Lahore. And I was had to stop my tracks and think, what? He was born in Pakistan? And she was like, yeah, but it wasn't Pakistan then. And that's when it hit me that he probably was part of this chaotic calamity that happened, that was partition. And we're only now really talking about the millions and millions of deaths that occurred, the millions and millions of people that died, that were murdered, the women that were murdered, either by their own families for protection of their honor, or by, you know, somebody from the opposite side. And yeah, girls in particular, women and girls, were this almost kind of product that had to be either saved or kind of killed off in honor. And there was, you know, women that went missing, women that were raped, women that were abducted and then converted. So all of this stuff was happening. And, you know, lots of people probably don't speak of it. All of this stuff was often silenced, and this trauma was just held, you know. Partition happened. People then started to settle in their newfound homes / communities. And that stayed with them. The fear of the other, you know, the other side. And I think this has massively scarred India and Pakistan and the relationships in between. And those scars still continue to hold because, you know, I know within own family members that they have strong beliefs around, you know, other communities. And I just think, gosh, why is it that you hold such strong beliefs? What is it? You know, why is there the need for the divide? And often people can't articulate it.
Yeah.
But we know that it is a inherited thing, this inherited discrimination.
Yeah.
So sadly, this is kind of how it continues down the line. And, you know, when you have women who have been abducted, raped, traumatized, whatever, and you have men who are often left feeling brutalized, demasculinized, you will see all sorts of coping mechanisms within the community to cope with that devastation. So this includes substance misuse, alcoholism, you know. This is the way that communities coped. And again, it's sadly passes down the generations, you know. And yeah, a lot of, and the stories I hear of how often the men were expected to be these protectors. The men were expected to be warriors, and that kind of toxic masculinity identity continues because they had to be that type of warrior. They had to be that type of man. And if they weren't, then, you know, they were shunned or whatever. And that now that kind of conversation still continues in certain communities, that in order to be a man, you need to be this kind of person. You need to be this type of physique. You need to drink X amount of alcohol. You know, so again, all of this drip, drip, drips. And what if you don't fit that bill? What if you want to, you know, become an artist or a creative and you don't want to work out at the gym 10 times a week or whatever? What if you don't want that? What happens to you then?
You fake it.
Absolutely. Or you feel like you're not enough, you know, or you feel that the messages that your communities hold are, well, he's clearly not like us. You know, you are ostracized, you are othered, which then has an impact on your mental health. Of course.
Absolutely. You know? And have you seen that firsthand with the South Asian young male population?
Yes. Yes, I think that toxic masculinity is a huge problem within our communities. 100%. It is sadly reinforced and perpetuated by popular culture as well. We know this through music and videos and Bollywood. There is very little room for diversity and nuance and difference. And, you know, different concepts of what does it mean to be a man. Similarly for women as well, you know, that the stereotypes sadly still hold in the majority sector. I think that there is a bit more of a shift, and feminism is obviously trying to try and eradicate that and really kind of, you know, level the playing field up. But again, it is sadly an upward battle. But, you know, I think that there are clearly some pioneers who are doing some amazing work out there that, you know, we're all trying to pitch in and do what we can. So
for sure.
Yeah, I think it's difficult when you've got such a culture that people buy into, like Bollywood, for example. And when you have that and people are buying that, those ideas, it's very difficult to shift from that.
Hmm. And how would you say that then translates into how you're bringing up your girls?
It's tricky because you've got you're almost going against the wave, aren't you? Going against the current. And the current is mainstream, these norms and these ideas around what a girl and a boy should be and, you know, whatever and everything in between. I think that what we have to do as parents is hold space for difference, hold space for it's okay if, you know, it isn't like that. It's okay to, you know, kind of see something that's different. And it's not about kind of shaming difference or to say that's not accepted, that's not how it should be. Now, sadly, growing up in the 80s, that's what I was taught as a child, that actually shouldn't be like this. It shouldn't be like you were saying. There was very strict kind of lines in terms of what is right and what is wrong. But actually, what we know is it's way more fluid than that. And there is no such thing as right and wrong in terms of your identity formation. You can be who the hell you want to be as long as you're a good person. So I think that it's about the language. It's about what you're trying to show children. You know, one thing that I'm making conscious decisions about is what they are consuming. Obviously, it's difficult that you can't tailor everything, but it's little things like what kind of books are they reading? Are they diverse books? Are they books about Black people? Are there books about, you know, East Asian people? Are there books about different cultures around the world? Are there books about, you know, stereotypical girls? Are there books about stereotypical boys? And how can we shift from those, you know, kind of binary ideas around what people should look like and be like? So it's about trying to integrate the complexity of what it is to be human. And that's hard because you can only do that in so many books. And education has a huge part to play in that. But as parents, we do also have a part to play in that as well, that the world isn't just one color or one type or one language. I was just laughing and joking with my girls before. They were talking to Alexa and they were saying, Alexa, speak Indian. I was like, okay, right, we need some education around the languages in India. But, you know, we do it in a playful way. Because you can get overwhelmed, you know, with the amount of stuff that we need to try and cover. But we all have a part to play in this. So I think that in order to keep mental health conversations alive, we have to be talking about feelings, identity. We need to be talking about beliefs, constructs and social constructs. We need to be talking about how to tune into our bodies and recognizing when our bodies feel wobbly or when they feel, you know, bubbly or angry or whatever it is. And we just keep that as part of a normal conversation. It doesn't even have to be, right, let's do the mental health talk. It has to just be while you're chopping up vegetables and they're beside you or while they're colouring in. It's just drop it in the conversation and you can pick it up and let it go. You know, it's literally like that. Just as we would do in adult conversations, it just falls in into the conversation. It should just be gentle. It doesn't have to be a thing. It is just a conversation.
How would you advise parents to drop that into conversation? What kind of words would you use yourself?
So I think that parents are very good at knowing what their kids can tolerate or understand. So it really depends on their developmental kind of age. When you are working with, this is average, again, you could have quite a high functioning 3-4 year old. But if you're looking at kind of, you know, reception age, you would be using very simple words, simple languages, probably even be using pictures to illustrate things, colors, symbols, imagery is what I would be kind of suggesting. And then as the child gets older, let's say 7-8, you can start to use more abstract constructs like happy, like frustrated. And again, I think that children really like using real life illustrations to describe things. So like using comic books or pictures or characters, that's a good way of bringing that in. And children are quite visual as well. So it's about using a combination of different things. The other thing is, again, using your senses as well. Senses is really important. So, you know, we use things like when your face goes all scrunchy or when your hands feel really like tense, you know, when you squeeze your hands, you know, you feel tense. When you feel all jelly, it might be that, you know, you might be either relaxed or anxious. Everybody's got different ways of describing things. You've got to co-create your own special language between you and your child. So it's really about being playful. And there is no right or wrong way of doing it. It's about doing your way. Because again, everyone's got their own way of communicating with their kids. I think that as long as you're having a go, that's good enough. And you could, you know, mess it up. I mess it up all the time. You know, they're like, oh, I don't want to talk, mommy. Well, okay. You know, you leave it. You don't push them. And the other thing I would say is that use yourself as an anchor. And I feel like that we don't talk about this enough because maybe we struggle to tune into our own emotions. Now, this is where the work usually has to start with the parents. So often, you know, I would say to parents is that, can you recognize anger in yourself? Can you recognize upset or low mood in yourself? Can you recognize frustration? Or can you recognize, any emotion that comes up for you, can you recognize that? How can you recognize that? And what we do naturally as human beings is we mirror and we tune in. And that's the beauty about how attachment is formed, is that we can look at somebody and really connect to them, you know, really look into their eyes and really know or guess how they're feeling just by interpreting and tuning into their body language. So, for example, I know that my daughter, the younger one, she's very good at hiding her emotions. She's really good at tolerating intense emotions. And she'll kind of have this weird smile on her face when she's like stubbed her toe or something. And she goes, that must have really hurt. It's okay to say it hurt. And she'll be like rubbing her toe or leg or knee or whatever. I'm okay. And I've got a very expressive older child that I'll just be like, ow, 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 you know, real dramas. And I'm like, okay, that really hurt. That's okay. You know, so every child's going to be different. But you will know as a parent how your child is feeling because you can look into their eyes and see that. You'll feel it. As a parent, you can't help it. You're connected to them. And this is the attunement that I was talking about that often South Asians talk about is that they just never got that deep connection from their parents. And this is a huge, huge thing for children to learn, because if you are in tune with your child's emotions and feelings, you can interpret them and you can then say, wow, that must have been painful, or oh, that's you know, I don't know, I'm just thinking of an example. If something broke of theirs and you know they're very young, they're a toddler and they get upset and they start to cry, you can use your language to say, oh, that's so upsetting, and I understand that you're crying because it broke, rather than stop crying. Because you can see the difference in that you're validating that child's emotions. You're in tune with that child because you are validating their emotions. The child feels like, oh, mommy gets it or daddy gets it. And I feel better now. And that's that's the crucial bit, is that when our emotions are validated and named and there is a space for those emotions, guess what? Those emotions dissipate. They soothe. And yeah. I see this time and time again in the therapy room, you know, or my virtual one, is that often we are all carrying stuff that we weren't able to talk about or aren't able to talk about for various reasons. And then when they come to, you know, come for therapy and they're talking about all this horrible, painful stuff, and the therapist validates that experience. And what I mean by validate is to name it, to say, wow, that must have been so awful what he or she said to you. I'm so sorry you felt that way. I wonder if it felt that they rejected you. I wonder, you know, and it's just about holding space rather than trying to shut that person's emotional experience down. It's about saying, you can feel this way. It's okay. Of course it's okay to feel angry, frustrated, annoyed, sad, rejected, whatever. Yeah. Because our emotions are valid and children's emotions are valid too. And, you know, this is one thing that I think that parents struggle with, is that they feel like that when a child cries, it's going to reflect badly on them and that they need to calm that child down as quickly as possible. But what calming looks like for them is to shut down that child's emotions straight away.
Yeah.
Either by telling them to shut up, be quiet, stop crying, or distracting them. Oh, look, here's a sweetie, stop crying. And I think both of those things are equally damaging as the other, because what you're saying is, you're crying, it makes me feel uncomfortable and I don't want your tears. Your tears are not welcome.
Yeah, and often like parents use this blanket term of discipline. And they say, well, I'm just disciplining my child because I don't want them going out of control.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, this is something that I had one of my aha moments. I was reading a couple of really good parenting books when I first had my kids. And if we look at the true word of what does discipline mean? Discipline means to teach. To teach is to get a person to think for themselves. That's to teach. To internalize that learning experience. We know that the best form of teaching is like coaching. It's getting them to think for themselves. So you think of all the times of all those teachers that have taught you, which teaching styles have stuck with you. And often it's the teaching styles that don't force you to learn something. It's the teaching styles that get you to think for yourself, this autonomous thinking. That is how the brain embeds the information. So I'll give you an example. If we're trying to teach a child not to hit, this is the tricky part, because obviously there's developmental stages that we need to be mindful of. If we're looking at really young children, What we need to aim for is a kind of very short, you know, discussion, because they can't comprehend and make sense of lots of information. So simple statements like hitting hurts. No hitting, hitting hurts. And that's probably as far as you can go. And then you remove the child from whatever situation it is, because they can't control themselves. They don't have the same brain functioning that an adult has or an older child has. And it's all to do with this lovely frontal part of our brain called the frontal lobes. And the frontal lobes are responsible, or are the gatekeepers, for abstract thinking, thinking about the other, you know, the ability to hold other things, other people, other situations in mind, future thinking, all of that really complex stuff which separates us from monkeys, let's say. So you've almost got to see the toddler as like a monkey in a way. You can't teach a monkey to stop hitting, because it's primal, it's instinctual. Mine, you know, that's what a toddler wants to do, and that is what they're going to do, because they are only thinking about the goal, and the goal is to get that toy. And if it means that I need to hit you for that toy, I will do it, you know? And that's kids for you. So you can't actually discipline, teach a child at that age. As they get older, what you'll find is that children are then better able to hold abstract thought and are better able to kind of reason. So this is probably around 5, 6, 7, where you start to see that really developing. Again, it just depends on the child. And you start to think about their teaching in stages. So often what we know about teaching is that it never ever occurs when a child or an adult is in a highly charged environment. So when they are in an emotional state, let's say, for example, two siblings have had a huge fight, they're physically pulling each other's hair. The first step is to establish safety. Make sure you've separated those children, okay? And then you need to think about, trying to help them to calm down, to get the kind of emotions down. You will not do your best learning when you are frightened or when you have lots of kind of, you know, when you are too busy trying to fight for something. Yeah. You're in that fight or flight. You will not retain any information. No information will go in. No information will be processed at that point. And we know this. So we need to be in a sense of safety, green zone, as I call it. Need to be calm. And that's the best time to learn something. Mm. So shouting at your kids, guess what that does? It gets your kids into the red zone. I'm scared. Why are they shouting at me? Or I'm really angry. Why are they shouting at me for? Why are they making me feel horrible or whatever it is? Yeah. So actually, that's not going to work. Shouting does not work. It might catch their attention for the moment, but you will not be able to do any teaching in that moment. So what you have to do as a parent is to kind of do things in stages, and then hopefully you will get a teaching moment at some point around that time, once the child has got down to a place where they are calm and regulated, soothed, quiet, calm, in a good state, where they'll be able to hear you. So that is the point where you will have that conversation around, right, what happened between you and why was it that so-and-so was screaming? Why was it that you were doing the hitting? What's happened there? Then they will go on to explain. And then you will kind of say, okay, right. You know, and then you would probably try and do a bit of problem solving with them. Ideally, you don't want to be doing it for them. You want to be giving them the opportunity to think for themselves. So kind of try and create different scenarios or different consequences. So let's say, for example, okay, so let's say, for example, you know, you're fighting over the Lego. What do you think would have stopped so-and-so from hitting you? You know, get them to think about that. What could you have done differently? So these are the valuable teaching moments that will get their brain to create connections.
Yeah.
Discipline in the traditional way of the most Asian parents and most parents, I think, in general, think is by shouting at them that they'll teach their child something. It doesn't happen. I myself am a guilty for it. I will raise my voice because sadly sometimes kids just don't listen. But I know for a fact that my teaching moments are my best moments when they're calm and they're listening, because I get my child to empathize. I get my child to think about the other, and I get my child to think about the consequences of their actions. That is teaching. That is discipline. And there's a huge difference. And it's, and you know, I've got my daughter in the back. Can you see? she's listening. That is how we teach. So it's not easy. Discipline is a really interesting word. And I think that as a society, we've got such a Victorian way of trying to teach our children or discipline our children. And we actually live in a punitive society. If you think about it, when we make a mistake, our prison system is a perfect example of that. When we make a mistake or when we do something wrong, we are incarcerated for it. when actually what we should be doing is looking at the reasons why that behavior is occurring in the first place. And, you know, I know that it's never a simple answer. It's going to be lots of different things that are contributing to a person behaving in a particular way. But, you know, what we need to be thinking about is what's underneath the behavior. What's the behavior actually telling us about, say, the child? What is it that they are trying to achieve from doing whatever they're doing? You know, this is the bit that we as a society don't have much tolerance for, is we don't have tolerance for the whys, the hows, and what can we do differently. You know, and that's hard. It's hard because we live in such a fast-paced society. We need to just earn the money, go on our holidays, you know, live these wonderful lives that we've been so-called told that we're going to live. We're chasing this dream, but actually I think what lockdown and you know, this whole coronavirus thing has made us do is to stop and reevaluate so much of that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What we're doing, how we're doing it, why are we doing it, and what actually matters. And, you know, I've read articles about, oh, we'll just go back to the way things were. Well, that's your decision. You know, it's totally your decision whether you'll go back to the way things are. Mm. Or you will keep digging, you will keep looking inwards, you will keep reflecting on the way that you behave around people or the way people behave around you. And there always should be time and space for that. There has to be.
For like the final part, I guess, of this podcast, I wanted to touch on the fact that obviously you run this incredible page called The Brown Psychologist, and you share so many great resources on there for the South Asian community. What hopes do you have for our community in terms of our mental health and taking care of ourselves post-COVID? I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah, no, it does make sense. I think that what I would love is that we each are able to find our tribe, that we are each able to find people that we can connect to and have these big, broad, open, honest conversations. Not all of us are fortunate to have a space where we feel like we fit in. And this is the problem, is that often we navigate spaces where we're constantly fragmenting ourselves, or we are not showing up as ourselves all the time. And I think that the aim of the Brown Psychologist page was firstly to kind of give a voice to the South Asian struggle, but also to bring a perspective of women in particular who come from a generation like me, where we didn't grow up with the internet as part of our lives from day one. We were of the generation where Facebook became a thing in our, you know, late teen years, and that conversations around you know, patriarchy and oppression and racism, they're newer concepts to us. We knew of them, but we never really had the spaces to talk about these things. And these struggles are for a kind of different, in that these people have one foot in the kind of traditional way of being, but also another foot in this more modern, open way of being as well. So we're kind of straddling this really in-betweeny world, where it just feels very kind of sticky on both ends, if that makes sense. And we are now trying to carve out a space for those conversations. And, you know, my specialist interests are around mothering and parenting and how, you know, growing up in this country has its positives, but also has its negatives, of how mothers' voices in the mothering world, it's pretty much white, middle class. You know, you look at all the baby and mummy magazines, they're all white people holding white babies, or, you know, you'll get the odd black person or the mixed race person, but you will rarely see a perspective of a South Asian mother, of her stories in it. You know, they're kind of different intersects around what is it like to be a brown mother. And so that's kind of something that I feel needs to be advocated, and we need to be talking about the fact that there are physical health inequalities within Black and Asian mothers as well. Why is there, you know, such disparity? Why is it that more Black women are dying at during childbirth? Why is it that, you know, Asian women have high levels of complications for whatever, you know? So this stuff is quite important to me, because there are different stages in a woman's life which I feel are hugely transformational, and they are around kind of when the girl gets her menstruation, her period. They are when a woman decides to get married. They are when the woman gives birth, becomes a mother, and when she hits menopause. So all the M's. And they are often points where women talk about their struggles, or they do experience struggles. And when they're kind of away from those particular points, they look back and think, oh my gosh, what an awful time, or what a tricky time, or whatever it was for me. I didn't have anywhere to go to talk about these things. So I think that with the combination of the Black Lives Matter kind of movement, and just how it had, you know, the whole George Floyd stuff had kind of erupted, and it erupted, you know, with full force, it has really forced us to look at ourselves, look at the racial disparities, really look at how within our communities, how we're treating each other and other communities, how mental health and inequality go side by side, and that actually we need to be having frank, honest conversations about the state of affairs that exist in this country, with regard to adequate service provision, because it's not. The fact that actually we need culturally sensitive therapy, we need more representation, we need more people that look like the people who want to access therapy, and we need to make therapy accessible for people who want it. Or need it. And we also need to decolonize the way that we see healing as well. And this is another message that I firmly believe in that there isn't just one way of healing. It doesn't have to be Eurocentric in its approach. We have so many wonderful ways of healing ourselves. And we should be proud of them. Just because they aren't scientifically rigorous, let's face it, most medical practices aren't scientifically rigorous. They just go on RCT trials that are set up for that kind of, you know, exploration of, okay, this many people, yeah, let's just go with it. It isn't always as robust as we'd like to believe. And that our practices have held on, like Ayurveda and yoga have held on for this long for very good reason. They work. They heal. You know, they're just two examples. There's tons out there that people are engaging in, you know, and ultimately it's about trying to create packages for people. And this is, you know, this is not me saying I'm prescribing your package. It's about looking at your own inner wisdom, looking at your culture's wisdom, your community's wisdom, and co-creating something that feels is going to be helpful for you. So it could be going to the gym. It could be going to seek spiritual guidance from your spiritual leader. It could be readings about CBT. It could be all of these things. You know, there's not one way of healing that trumps all the others. No such thing. You've got to do what fits right for you. You know, I often work with clients and I would be saying, okay, what are you into? And especially if they're young, which is quite cool, they talk about music, they talk about art, they talk about books. And this is when my heart starts pumping because I'm like, yes, right. Okay, let's go with what you've got and, you know, amplify that, really soup it up, because what we already have are our own ways of soothing, are our own ways of healing. Let's use those instead of trying to reinvent the wheel and try and make you do something that you just don't get. Why don't we use what we've got and really connect to it? And this is, you know, this is where I talk about doing things with intention. So if you do like exercise, do it with intention. Really do it because you want to, I don't know, sweat out, you know, a bad day. Or if you really like listening to music, really connect with the lyrics, really engage with the you know, sounds. It's about doing it with intention. But yeah, there's so many ways that we can heal this. And, you know, it's also not only being a consumer, but also being a creator that is hugely healing. So you know, by you doing this podcast and creating this podcast, it must be doing so much for your emotional well-being and your health, because you are creating joy. You are developing, you know, these muscles in your brain that give you a sense of worth, a sense of self-esteem. You know, it's adding to all of that. It's giving you a mindset that says, I can and I will, you know. So I believe in embracing it all. There's no one way of doing it. Sometimes we might need somebody alongside to help us kind of co-create that journey. And that's what I feel like my job is, you know. It's about creating a space. That's what I do.
That's so powerful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think I completely agree, because I use dance as therapy and I definitely use creating this podcast as therapy. I think whenever I'm recording, it feels like you just gone into some state of nirvana or something, and you just feel really, you feel like your life has a purpose.
Yeah.
And I think everyone deserves to have something that they can turn to.
100%. When we are creating, we give ourselves permission to just be. Just be. We don't have to jump through any hoops. Just be. See what comes. What magic is going to be created in this moment when we're creating? And, you know, I think that this is why it's so important that children play, that children stay within that playing mode for as long as possible. Keep engaging their creativity, because, again, you know, sadly, as a South Asian child growing up in this country, it was kind of like, okay, right, you've done your dance and drama. Now think about, you know, focusing on your studies. And I get it. I get why my parents kind of, you know, didn't really put too much emphasis on creativity. It was because it's about survival. It's about trying to make sure that I'm in a stable job. But guess what? You know, our communities have made their mark and we no longer need to survive. We are all in places where we can put our stamp, our mark in this country in particular. You know, even the US and the States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand, all these places, I'm seeing so many people that are doing powerful things where they are saying, hey, I'm brown, I live in this country and I own this. I am creating stuff that represents me and the people that I you know, I connect with. And that to me is just so beautiful, because, You know, I grew up in the 80s. It was like, you know, on TV, when you see a brown person, everyone runs around the TV and says, oh my gosh, it's a brown person on TV. It's amazing. And, you know, knowing that my children will look at the internet and look at the TV, hopefully, and music and all of that, I mean, we've still got a way to go. But seeing and hearing these conversations in the mainstream, it just shows that we've put our kind of, you know, our stamp here.
Mm.
We ain't going nowhere. We are staying here, and we are proud to be British Asian, you know, and that is what I want for my kids, to see that there have been people before them that have been doing this, and, you know, they can hear, listen into conversations about things that they will get, you know, that they will nod to and say, yeah, I feel that way. I feel that way.
Mm.
So it's, for me, this isn't about me. This is about legacy. This is about the next generation. This is about passing that baton on to the next generation. So as we were saying about intergenerational trauma, we're passing on intergenerational gifts.
Legacy. Oh, that's beautiful. I absolutely love that sentiment. And your kids are so lucky to have you as a mom.
Oh, they might not say that at bedtime.
Tina, just a last point before we wrap up. I want to know from you, what do you have strong game in? And what could you have stronger game in?
Oh, right. I have strong game in, I think that's easy. I have passion. I feel like ever since I was 4 foot nothing, I've always had passion for my kind of, you know, my community, my voice. I'm proud of who I am, what I am, where I've come from, all of that stuff. And I want to advocate for my community. I want to keep going. So that's where that strength is. Where I could be better? I think this is a tough one because I feel like I could be better at slowing down. I kind of do live at 100 miles an hour. But I also wonder whether that's because I have so many demands on me and I'm a bit ambitious and passionate. So I think that they come hand in hand in a way, don't they? That, you know, you want to do lots and lots of things. But I feel like that I do the typical thing, which is you kind of, you know, work yourself until you're forced to stop because your body's like, I can't do anymore now. And then I'm forced to stop. But even when I'm stopped, I still want to clean the house and, you know, do the cupboards and, you know, do something, you know. Yeah. And I think that's sadly my inherited trait of looking like I'm productive or being told I should be productive. So I think there's something about I need to get stronger at not feeling like I need to be productive all the time, and that I can sit and read a book if I want to, and that I can sit and listen to music, because I used to love doing that when I was a teenager.
Mm.
You know, I loved my random afternoons where I just listened to albums, you know?
Yeah.
And I miss that dearly. But yeah, that's something that I think I need to work on.
And also knowing that rest is also productive.
Oh, 100%. Of course it is. Yeah, absolutely. Because I think that, you know, we see rest as sleep.
Mm.
Oh, right. So now you rest when you sleep, you know. And I think that that's because of this whole kind of concept of productivity and the need to show our worth through our productivity. When in fact, rest can be just being in the moment. Rest can be lying on the grass on a hot sunny day and listening to the birds. That's probably one of my favorite things to do, you know? And not feeling guilty about it.
Yes.
That's the
definitely. Big one. I think that's the key.
It is. And it's something that I think we just need to pay attention to. Check in on ourselves, sure. Because we all can fall into that trap You know, as much as I advocate for rest and to all my clients, I know that I find it just as hard. So, yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Tina, and for your time today. It's been so wonderful to have you, and I really, really appreciate you coming on.
No problems. It's been awesome. Thank you for inviting me.